Kathy Kaufman. And he pulled the same thing on Larry. And Larry, that we talked about just before the meeting. Anyway, it's kind of funny because...
Good morning. I'd like to call the meeting to order. Thank you, everybody, for coming. And everybody looks bright and fresh. I had a shave last night. I had a full beard. I looked like this gentleman yesterday. And
now I'm
back to work. My face feels really weird. Not that anybody really cares. But,
it looks fine now. Thank you.
I know you're all concerned about that. Anybody willing to approve the minutes of our previous meeting?
So moved.
Thank you, Senator Metzen. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Minutes are adopted. Let's see here. Review and approve or approve collective bargaining agreements of Minnesota government engineers, law enforcement, and I'd like to invite up Mr. Paul Larson for his presentation. Mr. Larson, I understand this is a big day in your career to the state of Minnesota. Am I correct in the understanding this is your last meeting, sir?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. I announced my retirement. In fact, my last day will be this Friday, October 23rd. 37 years.
Wow, 37. Well, thank you very much for your service to the state of Minnesota, and certainly it's been a pleasure working with you. I've seen you out on the Gateway Trail. You're kind of focused, so you don't always say hi. But I think you're out in the dark like I am a little bit. So I'm not sure what to say about that. But it's good you're out there and you look fit and trim. But good luck to you. I hope you.
Well, thank you very much. The reason I'm.
Do you want a long meeting or a short meeting? What is your preference?
I'm kind of quiet on the Gateway Trail is because I'm listening to my Frank Sinatra tapes while I'm watching.
I love it. So.
Well, that's a neat. Mr. Larson.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Larson. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Minnesota Management and Budget. Also in that capacity, I serve as the state labor negotiator. I'm here today before you to present two negotiated labor agreements and two amendments to the commissioner's plan. The two negotiated labor agreements that I have are before you today, which I am seeking approval, are the Minnesota Government Engineers Council and the Minnesota Law Enforcement Association. The Minnesota Government Engineers Council is assigned to the State Bargaining Unit Number 12, and the Minnesota Law Enforcement Association is assigned to Bargaining Unit 1. With regard to the labor agreements, I'd like to give you a brief overview. First of all, these settlements mirror the previous settlements that have been brought before the Commission on June 29th of 2009. The highlights of the negotiated agreements are faced with the backdrop of the budget deficit that this legislature and the state system has faced in this biennium. In cooperation, these are voluntary settlements. This wasn't a real easy task, but nevertheless, these are voluntary settlements. And the general overview of the settlements provide for no across-the-board increases in either year of the agreements. It provides for a temporary halt to the first-year steps in the labor agreements, but then the steps in the second year will be granted. There are no changes in the insurance plan design for either year, and in the second year of the agreement, we will provide a $125 a contribution to a health reimbursement arrangement for the employees. But specifically, let me address the Minnesota Government Engineers Agreement. First of all, it's coinciding with Mr. Hubinger's summary, there are 927 employees assigned to this bargaining unit 12. The average step size is approximately 4%. There are 65% of the employees that are at the top of the pay scale, so that means once you're at the top of the pay scale, you're not eligible for the step increases. And on the adverse to that, the 35% of the employees in this unit will be eligible for the step increase. The ending base for this unit on June 30th of 2009 was $174,067,000. The new money that's going into this settlement is $1.033 million, of which it's important to note that in the, I believe, the 2008 legislative session, the legislature determined that there would be an increase in the employee and employer contribution for the Minnesota State Retirement System. This reflects that the 0.25% increase each year in the Minnesota State Retirement System. So of the new money that would the Minnesota State Retirement System contributes is $509,000. The percent increase cost from the previous biennium to this biennium is 0.59 of a percent, and the increase in the base is 1.55%. Specifically with the law enforcement agreement, there are approximately 700 employees assigned to this unit. This is the law enforcement unit for the non-supervisory employees. This, for the Department of Public Safety, includes troopers, special agents, and gambling enforcement officers. For the Department of Natural Resources, we have conservation officers, and for the Department of Commerce, we have insurance fraud specialists, and for the Department of Corrections, we also have fugitive specialists. The average step size for this unit is 4%. In this unit, 60% of the employees are at the top of the pay range, and therefore that means that 40% of the employees are eligible for the second year step. With regard to the costs associated with this settlement, the ending base for this unit on June 30th of 2009 is $128,088,000. New money going into this settlement is $1.504 million. And I want to acknowledge that of that $1.5 million, $931,000 is attributable to the pension increases that the employer was responsible for. This settlement also provides then, the costs associated with this settlement increase in the biennium is 1.17%, and the increase to the base at the end of this biennium will be 2.46%. And I believe that covers the overall presentation, and I'm here to answer any specific questions. I also want to acknowledge the relationship with the Minnesota Law Enforcement Association and the Minnesota Government Engineers Council in the give and take efforts that we had in reaching these settlements. I also want to advise you that we do now have a voluntary settlement with the Minnesota Nurses Association and the State Residential Schools Education Association. So that they're not here before you today. I have been advised that the nurses did ratify their agreement, and we are waiting to hear from the State Residential Schools Education Association. So with that, Mr. Chair, all of the agreements are complete. We ask the approval for these two agreements, and to also let you know that we did reach voluntary settlements with the other two units as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. Any questions? Senator Betts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Larson, I do have a question based upon Mr. Hubinger's summary. On the Government Engineers Council contract under point two, it said that some employees receive step increases between July 1st, 09, and the date of the tentative settlement, and that they were returned to the original level. Does that mean that they were given temporary pay raises, and then at some point they're reduced, and are they going to be having to pay back the raises they got? How does that work?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bethel, yes to your question. There's a provision in 179A, PELRA, which we commonly refer to it as, that provides, and I believe it's 179A.25, but it provides that the current contract that's in effect will remain in effect until a successor agreement is reached or either side elects to cancel the contract. The problem that we face then is that the steps in our labor agreements are not date specific. In other words, they're automatic. So on July 1st, With our other units, we were able to reach the tentative agreements and stop the steps before July 1st, because our goal was to withhold the steps in the first year of the agreement, because that was the most costly component of the steps. And we were unable to reach that agreement with the engineers on July 1st. And so as a result of that, we had to continue with the steps. And this was commonly referred to in our organization as spilling of steps, because we had to pay those steps out. But then what happened then, that then kind of changed the strategy from our bargaining point of view, because we had reached the voluntary settlements with all of the other units, and yet this HERA unit then had steps in the first year. And so it created a different element in the bargaining process, but in reaching our tentative agreement, what that means then is that for those employees that did get the steps, we stopped them. And then in the next year, when the steps are eligible to be awarded, there'll be a delay then in when that employee would get that step. So we recovered the money and treated everybody fairly in this process, and we were able to navigate through that.
Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair, if somebody were to receive the step, we're not talking about a lot of money, I'm assuming, but if somebody were to receive the step increase and then it was stopped and then they left government service, retired or whatever, there's no recouping of the money, I take it.
Mr. Larson.
There may be, Mr. Chair, Senator Betzel, there may be an instant like that where we may not be able to recoup the money, but we're anticipating that that shouldn't be an issue for us.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Larson, did when you they failed to reach any agreement by that time, was it specific to that point, or was it an overall agreement? I mean, could you have, could an employee have said, look, I'd rather just go along, you know, or is it something that you'd want to choose? A person would want that?
Mr. Larson. Senator Scheid, no. I mean, it's pretty specific. We have to award those, and the only choice we would have had would have been to cancel the agreement. This is an essential unit, and it just, we felt that this was certainly was something that we weren't going to let ignore, that we weren't going to ignore that, but we felt that this it just changed the strategy from the bargaining point of view.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, has this happened before?
Mr. Larson.
Chair, Senator Scheid, no, it has not. This is the first time.
Chairman.
Senator Metzen.
Is this, Mr. Larson, that the match for the deferred compensation of $400, is that pretty universal with the state employees? I think it's a great idea, and I don't think, quite frankly, it's enough money to encourage. We want to encourage people to do the deferred comp, and I think the state should up their ante a little bit, but times are tough now. But is that pretty standard, the 400 different?
Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzen, the deferred comp match is a feature that is in all of our collective bargaining agreements, and there are, I think the minimum is $125 up to $400. And this really is part of the give and take of the bargaining process, because those units where we have factored in the deferred comp match, that's been something that the union has compromised somewhere else, probably in a lower across-the-board increase or a delay or something like that. So some bargaining units really push hard for the deferred comp match. Others want to put the money in other places. And so that's kind of a choice that they have, and we're willing to work with them on that in the give and take of the bargaining process.
Well, I'm just, Mr. Chairman, just happy that we're continuing this on in this area, too, so in the law enforcement folks.
Any further questions? Senator Olson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Hansen, the provision that you just explained to us about the step increases with government engineers, that did not affect the law enforcement contract? Was that settlement occur earlier, or are they not on that same type of a schedule?
Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson. No, they all had that feature, but we were able to reach a voluntary settlement with the Law Enforcement Association before that occurred.
So, Mr. Chair?
Senator Olson, sorry.
Chair, the upcoming ones that are finally reaching agreement, what will be the impact there?
Mr. Chair,
Senator Larson.
This is not an issue with them. We did stop the steps on June 30th. So the unique discussion about the engineers is the only bargaining unit that will be before you.
Thank you.
Right. Seeing no further questions, may I have a motion then for SER-1?
I'd move it, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid. And thank you. That's been moved by Senator Scheid. Any further questions?
Mr. Chair, that's both contracts, the government engineers as well as law enforcement appears.
That's correct.
Both of them. Yeah. Both of them.
Yeah. That's under one, and then A and B would be. Good question. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
SER-1 has passed. Mr. Larson, we have another item.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I have before you two amendments to the commissioner's plan. The first amendment is the deletion of the Appendix L in the commissioner's plan, which is what we commonly refer to as the DHS no layoff provision. I'm pleased to say, Mr. Chair, that the Department of Human Services has advised me that restructuring has completely concluded at this point, and that the provision no longer applies. And I have to apologize. In our efforts to try to get the commissioner's plan before the commission on, I believe it was June 26th when you had your meeting, when we brought in all the other labor agreements and so on, we did have Appendix L in there, and I had been advised by the Department of Human Services that they wanted it out, and I did not get it out. And so as a result of that, in this opportunity to have this commission hearing today, we're proposing the deletion of that. It's really a housekeeping thing. Like I said, the restructuring has occurred, and it no longer applies. The second amendment that we have to the commissioner's plan is what I consider to be a housekeeping reference, and this has to do with the Office of the Legislative Auditor. As you recall, in the 2008 legislative session, the Office of the Legislative Auditor had received authority to develop their own pay plan subject to approval by the Legislative Advisory Commission, I believe. And that has occurred. It has been approved. But in anticipation of that, what we did was we deleted the provisions, non-compensation provisions, from the commissioner's plan, because that's where the terms and conditions of employment were for the legislative auditor. And so with the complete deletion of that, what we found out that the Office of the Legislative Auditor has only made adjustments with respect to their own pay plan with regard to compensation. And so the amendment here reestablishes that with the exception of compensation, all other terms and conditions for the commissioner's plan do apply for the employees of the legislative auditor. So, and it's something we currently have been doing, but this cleans it up and clarifies where they belong with respect to the non-compensation issues. I'd ask for your approval of those two amendments.
Okay. Any questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Larson, forgive me if I missed your saying so, but, I mean, do we just not have any layoffs? Or, you know, and what is the policy? Is it governed by something separate?
Okay.
Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, the provision in the no layoff agreement provided a variety of options. Now, this was in the late 80s when we had the large regional treatment centers. Mm-hmm. Some of the options were retraining, other jobs within the Department of Human Services, or enhanced separation packages. And now with the closure of all of those facilities, and the employees have now moved out into those group homes, this provision no longer applies. So, no, it impacted a lot of people. It was a good tool for us, and it's worked well for the last 25 years, I guess I would say, but it's no longer needed.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, move the SER too? I mean, I don't think that's premature. These are pretty much housekeeping kinds of things. That's okay. All right.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. Any further questions? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Adopted. So is this it then, Mr. Larson, or are you coming up later? Or?
No. The only other thing I would like to say, and that is the Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget found the successor for my position. Her name is Barb Holmes, and Barb is here today. I'd like to acknowledge Barb. Some of you may remember Barb. She used to be a legislative liaison and also worked with me in the Labor Relations Bureau about 15 years ago, and I couldn't be more pleased than to know that we have someone in her capacity that has replaced me for my position. And I also want to say that it's been an honor to serve before this committee. I've been in front of this committee for many, many years. Some of you, I've testified against some of your legislation. Some of you have testified on behalf of your legislation. It's been a remarkable career, and I don't think that it happens this often, but I want to depart by saying that you guys do a great job for the citizens of this state, and I don't think you get enough credit for that, and I've admired the work you do.
Is this on television today?
And will you miss us?
I really do
reenact this.
Don't
or
go
something.
That far.
I really do want to acknowledge the work you do. Thank you.
Well, Mr. Larson, thank you for your service, and very much appreciated. And I hope everything goes well for you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Hansen. Commissioner, I was playing hockey yesterday with your boss, and we had an empty net. We could use a goalie. I have a star goalie, I guess, over here to my right, but we can't get him to come out.
I was looking at Senator Scheid.
And
where'd you play? Where was that, Dakota?
It was, we played at last week there in your home rink, but this was at Highland, and the governor's skating well. He's he likes it when we pass to him.
Yeah,
now
I'm
is
sure
that now as a Democrat, do I have to pass to him or I do though?
But Mr. Chairman, I usually get a lot of work after he plays hockey because people talk to him and then he calls me and says, "Well, can we do this? Can we do that?" So,
well, he's actually a pretty good hockey player, and it would be nice to have one more. We were short a goalie. We had a board in the net, and it would
stop more than I would. The board.
Would have been nice to have an all-star goalie. So, well, Mr. Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. We're here to discuss unemployment law judge compensation. In this past legislative session, the Economic Development Finance Bill contained a provision tucked neatly away and way right in the middle that required the Commissioner of Finance, along consulting with the Deputy Commissioner of Deed as well as the Chief Unemployment Law Judge, to determine and implement the appropriate pay level for unemployment law judges. It stipulated that we couldn't go more than two steps above where they are now, and that we had to take into account the less formal nature of an unemployment insurance hearing. And Mr. Hubinger's memo does a pretty good job at summarizing the issues. So this is a relatively unique issue to bring to you, in part because we have 1,800 classifications and 42,000 state employees, and it's unusual that one specific group works through the legislature. In this case, Senator Betzold's State or Government Finance Committee didn't see this, nor did the GovOps committees in either body. And I would say, Mr. Chairman, you will never see Mr. Larson on that trail if you start getting all these 1,800 classifications to do the same thing. You all will be sitting in this room arbitrating every single solitary compensation request in state government. That's my little aside. We are here because in order to do this and to implement the pay increase for unemployment law judges, we have to get an amendment to the commissioner's plan. So Assistant Commissioner Judy Plant will be discussing the options. We are bringing you options without endorsement because the legislation doesn't say for us to do that. It is a. It has gone through. It's safe to say, and that having gone through normal channels, that this compensation adjustment would not have this compensation adjustment would not have been approved by MMB. So with that, Judy Plant will talk about some of the options, and we'll leave it to you to make the alteration in the commissioner's plan.
Ms. Plant.
Mr. Chair, members, Judy Plant, Assistant Commissioner at MMB. I just want to give a little history and context before I review the options that are before you. We did, in the previous to MMB iteration of the Department of Employee Relations, there were some conversations with Deed back in 2007 about the compensation for UI judges, with the intent that the next step would be going through the regular possible range reassignment process. And that did not commence. And so in the 09 session, as the commissioner said, this language occurred in the Economic Development Omnibus Bill. And so the language does say that the commissioner, in consultation with the deputy at Deed and the UI chief judge, should determine compensation. And so we originally thought, initially, on quick read, that this would be a typical range reassignment study. However, the language specifically limits what we can do. The final sentence or partial sentence of the piece says, giving consideration only to the pay level provided to workers' compensation judges, but taking into account the less formal nature of the unemployment insurance hearing. And for us, that word only is particularly problematic. So a typical range reassignment study is not what we were able to do. Let me tell you what's involved in the typical range reassignment study. Our usual process is to, first of all, look at the positions involved and look at the position descriptions to see that they're accurate, because jobs do change over time. We want to make sure we're looking at the correct responsibilities, skill sets, et cetera. And so we typically update those PDs. And then we do a HAY evaluation, which is to use a uniform and well-recognized process of evaluating the skills and difficulty of the job. That does not automatically translate into compensation all by itself, but it is a benchmark up against other classifications in the state. We then look at market factors, recruitment. Are we having success in recruiting candidates for the job? Is there an availability of qualified applicants? And we also do look at wages paid by other employers for comparable work. Obviously, public sector pay is not going to equal private sector pay for many jobs, but we certainly do look at other public sector entities paying for comparable work to make sure we're at least on par with them. We also look at workforce planning issues, pending retirements, turnover rate, are we having trouble with retention? We look at the effect of salary compression. As we all know, it's a factor in our world. We look at the relationship to other positions within the department. We look in relationship to other classifications across state government. And then finally, we also consider the state of the budget and the timing for the request. So those are the typical things that we consider in a range reassignment. So being told to only consider one factor, which is the relatively or the more informal nature of a hearing, and to only consider the relationship to workers' comp judge salaries, is problematic because it precludes our doing any of the things that we ordinarily do to determine salary. I was searching for an analogy to use, and I'm really bad at sports analogies, so I won't go there. As the commissioner will tell you, I pretty well mangle sports analogies. But I came up with a really hokey one. If you go to a baker and ask them to bake a cake and tell them, bake me a cake, but don't use eggs or sugar or vanilla, you're left with the flour and water. So our challenge was to either come to you with flour and water and say it's a determination of salary, or to say we can't do it, given that limitation in this specified language. So we can't honestly make a determination by only looking at those things, and we are precluded from looking at the others. So with that, we do have several proposals that were put forth by the department, DEED, and we do have some comments on those proposals. I'd like to walk through those with you.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, could you, again, just read the language of the appropriations bill, how that read?
Sure.
I'm sorry.
Ms. Plant.
Mr. Chair, Senator. Laws of Minnesota 2009, Chapter 78, Article 4, Section 49, Unemployment Law Judges. It is in the public interest as well as the interest of applicants and employees that an unemployment law judge conducting contested unemployment insurance hearings should be an experienced attorney with a background in civil, criminal, or administrative proceedings. An unemployment law judge should have a level of skill equal to that of a workers' compensation judge. In order to recruit and retain individuals with the appropriate skills, the pay of an unemployment law judge should be commensurate with that of a workers' compensation judge, but should also take into account the less formal nature of an unemployment insurance hearing. Before October 1, 2009, the Commissioner of Finance is directed, in consultation with the Deputy Commissioner of Employment and Economic Development and the Chief Unemployment Law Judge, to determine and implement the appropriate pay level with no more than two pay steps for unemployment law judges, giving consideration only to the pay level provided to workers' compensation judges, but taking into account the less formal nature of an unemployment insurance hearing. That's the phrase that gets us into a bind.
Senator Scheid?
Mr. Chairman, no, thank you. That was helpful to me to get the context of that. Thank you.
So in front of you...
Ms. Plant, we all have a copy.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
Maybe this is an inappropriate question to ask in this setting, but you said the language occurred in the bill. Somebody had to put it there. I mean, do you know from whence this language came? And was it very thoroughly discussed or vetted? Or what can you tell us about its process for inclusion?
Ms. Plant.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'm afraid I have no history on this myself.
I don't know. Does anybody know?
Commissioner Hanson.
Chairman, Senator Olson, it didn't, as I referenced, it didn't go through GovOps or Senator Betzold or Senator Kahn. Those are the usual places we have markers out to watch for things like this. It isn't buried in the state, you know, the economic development bill. So, no, we don't. I don't really know the context from where it came.
No.
Isn't this?
We never saw it. Thomas Oney's bill.
I must say I have a little bit of concern with some of what I'm hearing, and I'm not sure that we're going to be able to come to a decision on this today. That's just kind of my comment as a chair, and I mean, if it's the will of the committee to certainly move forward, but I certainly want to hear the presentation. And Senator Olson?
Mr. Chair, then this is something that may need some attention in the next legislative session. Is that what you're suggesting? But there was some deadlines. And will the compensation have to be set prior to that happening?
Commissioner Hanson. Senator Olson, the language in and of itself, to determine and implement it, and in essence, the language is telling you, this committee, what you have to do.
Yeah.
Because we don't have the authority to change any of the compensation plans. You know, we come to you for that authority and for your approval. So to determine and implement, I mean, that's one of the problems with trying to do all of 1,800 classifications. The legislation's telling you how to act.
So, Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
So what are the consequences of if we were to not act? Do we get kicked off from this commission?
You're a life member.
Mr. Marks, it's a good thing we have a talented staff here. And Mr. Marks, do you have a suggestion? Are we chained and brought before these judges?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, no, I don't think. First of all, as Commissioner Hanson has indicated, the law is not completely clear. But the burden that is here is put on the commissioner, Hanson. It says that the commissioner is directed to determine and implement the appropriate pay level And Commissioner Hansen has stated that he has now done that within his scope of his power by presenting it here. I don't see any duty here for this committee to take action on this. So I don't think there's a consequence to this committee to not acting. If somebody believed that that the commissioner wasn't implementing the law correctly, in theory, they could bring a legal action claiming that the commissioner should have implemented this, but I don't think that is likely to be successful for two reasons.
Senator Olson. Mr. Chair, sir, so what you're saying is that in spite of the action that was taken with the commissioner's plan, we have now, the statute has overridden this group's action and given the power to the commissioner to make a change in that without coming before us. So if he was directed to do that, then why is he even having to bother with talking to us?
Mr. Shepherd, and I'm sorry for my misfire on your name.
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, I think the commissioner is acting appropriately. The statute is not clear. The statute does not recognize the fact that this commission and the full legislature typically approve changes to the compensation plan. So I think Commissioner Hansen is doing exactly what he believes that he needs to do to implement this plan, which is to present it to this commission, which then has authority, if it so chooses, to put it into effect on an interim basis, subject to approval by the full legislature. So I think it's because this law is not clear, Commissioner Hansen's in a difficult position, but I believe that he is doing exactly what he believes he needs to do to implement the law, and that this committee retains its authority to act or not act.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Commissioner Chairman, Hansen. Senator Olson, I would, I'm presuming that the purpose of this language was not for not to overturn every tenet of how we do compensation plans, and that is to come before you and get the appropriate approval. That it probably would have said that if it meant for us to do that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Betzel.
Well, I do see a lot of other people here today. Is there anybody else who happens to be here who knows any background on what this is? Because I'm not inclined to move forward on this until I find a little bit more information and background, how this language got drafted and put in a bill in the first place, circumventing the appropriate policy and budget division. So I think that we would not be prudent to move ahead unless we can get some more information.
Senator Betzel, it's been suggested maybe Mr. Gustafson come forward. Does he? Do you have some history or?
Does any?
I guess the one responsible is no. Wow. Representative Obermiller, good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank
I've missed you. You're my seatmate. And
right. I wish I could say I put out this actual draft of this language. I'm Mike Obermiller. I'm a representative from Egan. I was involved, however, in putting this language into place. There were hearings on this issue held at the Higher Ed Workforce Development Committee meeting. The original law, as I put it into place, is an amendment onto our omnibus bill, actually onto other bills before that, I believe, but set the pay rate in statute as a percentage of workers' comp pay. And the reason for that, from my perspective, is we're at a spot in our history with our unemployment law judges where we've got good quality people there, but going forward, we need to make sure we have the attorneys that are there with the experience that's necessary to make the kind of judicial decisions we want. In other words, we're looking, going forward, we want to make sure we're upgrading and hiring new people in. The original amendment was prospective, meaning that July 9th, anybody who was hired after July 1st, 2009, would be hired in at the new level. So in other words, as people left, new people would be hired in, higher pay raise at that point, meaning we're recruiting from a different pool of candidates than we originally were again. My understanding was Commissioner McElroy didn't like that provision that made it through the House side of the conference into the conference committee, and directed the folks to put new language to implement a study instead to do that. And that's the language that's here is from a study, was meant to put a study in place and then implement that statute. Make sure that the number I had picked, based on not just me, but consultation with ULJs and so forth, make sure that number made sense. So that's kind of the background of how the law got in there. It was discussed and testimony was taken on it in the conference committee as well on that provision.
Senator Betzel.
So, it's, Mr. Chair, it sounds like there was a House amendment, but there was never a bill. Is that a fair statement?
Representative Obermiller.
Mr. Chair, yes. Yes, Senator.
Okay. And Senator Betzel. Mr. Chair, then, in the Senate, in the conference committee, the Senate accepted whatever the amendment was that was in the House bill, but never in the Senate bill. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, yeah. It was in the original House bill. This language that's actually before you was new language that was introduced at the conference committee level. The original language was in the House bill. It was accepted initially and then changed.
Okay.
Senator Betzel.
And then, Mr. Chair, was the language that said we could only look at certain factors and not others, was that part of the original language or was that adopted along the way?
Representative Obermiller.
Mr. Chair and Senator, the language, but only looking at those, tied it to the fact that the unemployment law judge in the original language as introduced was connect the pay to the workers' comp judge. Because workers' comp judges are tied to the district court judge already, it was basically a three-tier, you know, the idea was a three-tier system where we'd say we're setting our pay using the Hay study and everything for the regular judges, the district court judges, and we're tying the pay down to the workers' comp judges, and then we're further tying the pay down to the ULJs. They're all doing the same type of work with a little less formality. That's the language that ended up in the provision.
But again, Mr. Chair, Representative Oberman, it isn't clear to me, was that language, the word only, was that part of the original House proposal, or did that morph into some compromise language along the way? Because obviously that's key language to the department, and I'm just trying to figure out where that came from.
Mr. Chair, Representative Obermiller. That language would have only been in the new proposal that came before the conference committee, because the original law didn't have a study at all. It just said 75% of what unemployment law judge would make, 75%, I believe, of whatever the workers' compensation judge made. So the original language that I proposed was from July 1st, 2009, new hires would get 75% of workers' comp judge pay.
Senator
Beckman. Okay, well, Mr. Chair, just from what I'm hearing, the language probably wasn't very well vetted. So I'm not sure that this commission is in a position to move ahead with it, and we may have to revisit it during the coming legislative session. That's just my impression so far. So,
which is valued as chair of the committee.
Well, I think Representative Kahn would also probably want an opportunity to take a look at this too, so among others. So,
yeah. Representative O'Baylor.
Thank you. I wanted to make sure there was some background. The issue was that, in fact, did go through some committees, a committee. It didn't make it through Representative Kahn's committee, and because of the fact that it was attached to that bill. But I just didn't want the committee to think that there had been that no one had heard this and had been tucked in during the dark of night. The issue had been discussed. This particular language did not make it through a committee, but other than the conference committee. But there was public testimony on the issue.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Betzel.
There's a value in introducing a bill. Because if there's a bill introduced, then both bodies get a chance to look at it and send it to the appropriate committees and budget divisions so they can have an opportunity. When it's just introduced as an amendment somewhere along the way and conference committees, one conference committee adopts it, then you do leave out the appropriate people. So my recommendation or suggestion is to, you know, have a bill introduced for the 2010 session and then the appropriate committees and budget divisions in both bodies get an opportunity to look at it and see where it needs to go.
Thank you very much.
Mr.
Thank you, sir. Ms. Plant, were we kind of there with your part? Or do you have, you had this chart to go through.
I do have the chart to go through, depending on your wishes at this point.
Senator Betzel, what...
Mr. Chair, I would lay this matter over and until a bill is introduced in the 2010 session to look at it, I'm not I certainly am not prepared to look at this. In fact, I think that there's reasons why we should not be looking further at this issue at this time.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Metzen.
I agree 100% with Senator Betzel. I don't think there's any need to go through this stuff but now. Let's lay it over and... I agree something has to get done in this area, but just the way it's being handled troubles me quite a bit. So,
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I just would like... I don't disagree, but I'm wondering... I just want to clarify that the workers' comp judge salaries are tied to the district court judges. Is that statutory? And we've done that in the past.
Yeah.
And have we also then set the UI or the unemployment, the ULJs, in statute as well?
Just I see a lot of nodding, but if we could get Ms. Plant to actually say it on
the record.
Mr. Chair,
Senator, the UI judges are part of the commissioner's plan at this point.
Okay.
And so they are on a pay grid within that plan. They are not set by
statute. I get it.
It seems to be the will that we could lay this over and certainly discuss this further. And I think staff was kind enough to tell us that this might not quite be ready yet. But thank you very much. I think we have someone that wants to testify, apparently a couple people. Do you want to... Commissioner Hanson and Ms. Plant, thank you, and might want to stick around for a couple minutes. But I believe we're going to, if you want to come forward and please state your name for the record. And I think it's pretty clear that the committee's certainly not closed on the idea. We just need to have some further discussion.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, my name is Fritz Knack. I formerly served in the Senate. And am quite capable of counting heads. And I see what's I see the sense of the commission and our committee, and I understand that. Nevertheless, this legislation did address some fairly critical lacking in what was perceived to be institutionally what was going on in the unemployment compensation area generally. And the response was, which was a sensible response, and it was the same response that at one point the legislature did with respect to workers' compensation judges, was to link it overall to the compensation of judges. It's a judicial function that's involved here. Mm-hmm. And we have seen, and again we saw it today, the institutional resistance that I recall was also the case when worker compensation reform came on the part of the administration on this issue. And there was resistance and parenthetically, I represent individually all of the unemployment compensation judges, one of whom, Mr. Gilliam, is with me here today and would like to make a few comments as well in a moment. But I wanted you to know that this has been the resistance we've been facing all along. And it's understandable. I mean, you know, if anybody understands what's going on in the economy right now, it's unemployment compensation judges. And they're keenly aware of this, but a lot of the push for this kind of reform has actually come from outside of this department, from others who have an overall concern about the level of quality that we would like to see continued and, if anything, increased in this area. And with that brief preference, Mr. Chairman, if I may, I would introduce Mr. Gilliam, who would like to make some comments, I believe. Okay.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Frank Gilliam III. I'm proud to be an unemployment law judge in the Department of Employment and Economic Development. I've been a public lawyer for most of my 37 years of practice. I think you've heard from the commissioner and the deputy commissioner. What we've seen is the institutionalized bias against this legislation. Flawed or not, the legislation directed MMB to conduct a study, and it didn't want anyone in telling MMB how to set salary. And a cursory reading of the study will clearly demonstrate the bias that they had already concluded a year ago without a study that no pay adjustment was necessary. It says that on the very first page. They then did the very kind of study the legislature told them not to conduct to reinforce their own preconceived notions. When it was called upon to do the comparison, it was less than a page. It was riddled with factual errors, including that we discouraged participation from attorneys and that we do 15 to 20 hearings a day. We did 4 hearings a day until the dramatic increase in the number of claims. We do 5 hearings a day, every day. We conduct hearings, we take testimony, we make a decision, and we write a decision that supports our analysis. My concern today, and I can appreciate as well as Mr. Knock the sentiment of this committee, is that we're not going to ever get a fair study. They've decided that we're not entitled to any sort of a pay adjustment. The highest salary of a current unemployment law judge with 30 years' experience is $76,000. Every workers' compensation judge makes approximately $113,000. They're hiring lawyers right out of school to be unemployment law judges, paying them not a entry level, and MMB concludes we don't have any trouble recruiting and retaining unemployment law judges.
Mr. Valium.
I could go on, but I don't have anything more to say.
Okay. I just want to I appreciate you both coming up. I'm glad you had an opportunity. Just my understanding of this issue is I can look around, but I don't think any of us are opposed to your wages. So this grand conspiracy kind of almost language that you're pulling out is a little unnecessary for me anyways. But, you know, I don't have the length of history of your 37 years in this, so maybe you've seen some things that I haven't. But the folks that I've talked around this table are not certainly a part of that. And I don't believe from my conversations with Mr. Hansen that that this is part of that either. But we're going to bring this up again. We're going to talk about it. And I don't know if there's any further comments. Senator Metzen was chair preceding me, and maybe he can speak to this issue as well. And
let me just, Mr. Chairman, say that I've always had the philosophy that you got to pay people, good people, that have been around and doing a good job. And I think we have to clarify this once and for all to get the percentage of the other judges. And I think you're probably the only group that's not tied to something. Is that correct? I think we got to get it done, and I'll vote to up the salary, if you will. But we just got to do it the right way, and I think that's where I'm coming from. And we'll get this fixed up. We'll get it fixed up and pay people what they should have coming.
Thank you, Senator Metzen. Senator Betzel.
And Mr. Chair, I'm a stickler for the legislative process. We've had over 2,000 bills that were introduced in the last legislative session. Introducing 2,001 bills would not have caused any problem with the process. This issue came about, as I understand it, from a House amendment, which the Senate never saw, until a conference committee when the language was changed. So to say the legislature directed is technically correct, but it doesn't get to the fact that the people in both bodies of the legislature that needed to see this issue never saw it. And so if you want something to be moved ahead in the legislature, again, there should be a bill introduced. The session starts February 4th. We all know that. There's no reason why a bill cannot be introduced on February 4th that can start moving the process to properly place this issue before the appropriate committees in both bodies so they can work on it. But if you're going to go that route to have it as an amendment in one body and only one conference committee looking at it, that's a recipe for trouble. So, you know, I have nothing to do with what the administration is working on, But the legislature has its process, so please follow the process if you'd like to have some interest in this issue.
Thank you, Senator Betzel.
Senator Knack.
Senator Knack.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'm deeply appreciative of what has just been said by Senator Betzel. I do want the committee members, however, to understand that this isn't a game of legislative gotcha. It's not as though the unemployment compensation judges tried to get something inserted into legislation and that this is the result of this. Certainly, if that is the wish of this committee, no one is going to have a problem introducing a bill. This wasn't part of any kind of effort on their part. However, they are responding to it, and it does meet a concern that they have. And I think you've heard, of course, Mr. Williams articulate very clearly the concerns that that group does have, and they will be following up with this. But I didn't want to leave you with the impression that somehow this is some kind of manipulative behind-the-scene games that's been handled. It hasn't been generated in that way. But you can see that the issue here is fundamental and important, and we're very appreciative of some of the supportive comments that members of the committee have made. Finally, and parenthetically, Mr. Chairman, I was on the Gateway Trail yesterday. You were playing hockey, so that's why I didn't run into you. But I expect that I'll be seeing you out there now that we know each other. Thank you very much.
It's quite a great trail. Thank you, Senator. I don't know if the questions are for you, but Representative Drazkowski.
Mr. Chair, do we have a motion on the table by Senator Scheid, I think, to...
Mr. Chair, I had suggested that the chair just lay it over. That's the inherent authority of the chair, just to lay it over. I mean, we could move it to table. We could take a vote on that. But if the chair just says I'm laying it over, it's laid over. So.
And.
No.
That is my intent, to lay it over.
Thank you.
I'd like to lay this over for...
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Members. Thank you very much for coming. And my apologies to Mr. Moe and Mr. Gustafson but for not having an opportunity to come before us, but I think you'll probably be all right. Any other comments on that? I think... Commissioner Hansen, do you...
Mr. Chairman, members, I feel it necessary to make a few comments after the last testimony. My concern all along in this has been that there wasn't the type of due process we have when we talk about compensation. I've yet to run across any of the 1,800 classifications where somebody doesn't think they should be paid more. And it's our responsibility to fairly administer these classifications. As we proceed forward, we'll have the opportunity to talk about that, in part before the relevant committees that see these issues. But we, I think, can make a fairly good case that it normally won't. It's not an institutional bias. I can walk through point by point why we don't think that this particular group deserves to be paid more at this time. But it needs to go through the relevant committees, and all we ask is the ability to communicate with them at the appropriate time.
Thank you, Commissioner. Mr. Morocco?
Good work, yeah. Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning, sir. Please state your name for the record and go ahead when you're ready, sir.
Sure.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Nathan Morocco. I'm the director of the Employee Insurance Division, and in that role, I oversee the State Employee Group Insurance Program, which is the insurance plan for all state employees, including other entities such as the legislative body. I was asked to speak a little bit about the consumer-directed health plan that we were asked in the 2008 legislative session to implement. This should be fairly quick, so with that, I will start. Just as a refresher, in the 2008 session in 43A.23 sub 1D, the legislature had asked that in both the commissioner and the managerial plan contracts that we offer a high deductible health plan as defined in section 223 of the U.S. Internal Revenue Service. So essentially this is a consumer-directed health plan or high-deductible health plan that has an HSA component for the managerial and commissioner plan employees. In terms of plan design, we essentially have taken this plan and built it on top of the existing tiered product that we have in the traditional Advantage program. So for those of you who do and participate in our program, you're familiar with the fact that we tier all providers on a scale of 1 to 4, 1 being the most efficient, 4 being the least efficient, and then we incent our employees to seek those providers that demonstrate higher efficiency for better outcomes. So we essentially then built plan design around that existing tier structure. On page 5, you can see the plan design, but on a couple highlights, we still continue to maintain 100% preventative care services. There will be a $1,500, $3,000 single-family deductible. Where normally we would differentiate tiers in the traditional Advantage plan using copays out for office visits as an example, in this case we would then be doing it through coinsurance, which is what is required of these kinds of plans. The maximum out-of-pocket for these programs would then be $3,000 for single and $6,000 for family. We will continue to use the existing health plan administrators, being Health Partners, Blue Cross, and Preferred One, and we'll still continue to use Navitus as our pharmacy benefit manager. In terms of the health savings account, the employer will be contributing to that account $700 for single and $1,400 for family in 2010. These contributions may vary in 2011 depending on experience. Employees will also be able to contribute to the HSA using their own dollars on a pre-tax basis as allowed by federal law. The current limits for 2010 would be about $3,000 for single and about $6,000 for family. So essentially, a member could contribute about $2,100 of their own money if they so choose on a pre-tax basis for single, and approximately about $1,600 then of their own. If I did that right, of their own dollars on a pre-tax basis, and we will certainly be doing that for any of the employees who are part of our central payroll system. That allows us to do the pre-tax dollars centrally and move those over to the plan administrators. There are some entities that participate in the CGIP program that administer their own payroll systems. We're working with them to see what their capabilities are in that sense. If for some reason there was another entity that was not part of central payroll that was unable to do this, certainly individuals can do this on their own. The tax benefit is the same. They just simply do it as part of their year-end tax process rather than through the convenience of a payroll deduction system. And of course, for those of you who are familiar with health savings accounts, the benefit is that first of all, you get to invest the dollars much like you would a 401k or other kind of retirement type of program, and there is no use it or lose it provision that would be part of a typical flexible spending account, which is something that you may be familiar with as well. Lastly, then. In terms of cost on page 7, the cost will be neutral both to the state and to employees. So essentially, the high deductible health plan or consumer directed health plan, because there is more out of pocket exposure to the member, that allows the premiums to the employer to be cheaper. Okay? So when we set the premium for this consumer directed health plan, we did so assuming that there would be a certain mix of employees coming into the program, those that are likely to be very healthy that we typically don't spend money on in the program, and those that tend to be have a fairly high illness burden, both of which can create some adverse selection. So that's something that we'll need to be managing as we move forward with this program. So with that, there will be no fees to the member. The premiums will be the same to the member. And so our job really, and we're doing this currently as part of our open enrollment process for this year, is to really explain to our members how this program works and where this might be a good fit for our members and perhaps where it may not be. So in essence, this covers about 7,000 employees out of our about 50,000, 51,000 employees in total that are eligible for this CGIP get program. And with that, I will be happy to answer any questions. There is a Q&A on the back page, but I'll leave that to you to read.
Any questions for Mr. Morocco?
Yeah,
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, I guess I didn't tune in. Who is eligible?
So a base.
Mr. Morocco.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, Senator Merkel. Olson. It, as directed by the legislature, it is for anyone who, for any plan that is based on the commissioner and managerial plans. So those would be people who are directly in those plans, as well as other compensation plans whose authorization to participate in CGIP is based on the commissioner's plan. That is why folks such as you, you know, the governor's office, the administrator's plan with MNSCU, a lot of what we refer to as the independent billing units, which are sort of quasi-state agencies like the Historical Society, Affinity Plus Credit Union, all of those entities, if you look in 43A at their eligibility to participate, it specifically references the commissioner managerial plan programs.
So we're not. The rest
you would be.
Would be?
That is correct. Yes, as so based on your specific language in 43A24 sub 2, it reads, the following persons are eligible for state-paid life and hospital medical and dental benefits as contained in the plan established pursuant to 43A18 sub 2, which is the commissioner's plan, a member of the state legislature. And it goes on to list many other entities that also are referenced to have eligibility based on the commissioner plan.
Senator Olson.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Morocco. Any further questions? Thank you very much. Ms. Slam? Ms. Lamb, welcome. Thank you very much for coming. And please state your name for the record and go ahead when you're ready. I see you bought a dial-a-friend, which is always a good idea, I think.
I have a dial-a-friend with me. Thank you, Mr. Chair and other members of the subcommittee. My name is Lori Lamb. I'm the Vice Chancellor for Human Resources at Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, and I've held that position since July 1st, taking over for Bill Cheetah, who I'm sure you know and remember well with this committee. I also have with me Mr. Jim Lee. He's our Director of Compensation, and he's here to bail me out in case I get in over my head. He knows the history of our personnel plan for administrators in much more detail than I do, so he'll be able to help me out whenever I need to. But I do appreciate the opportunity to be invited here today to address to you, for my first time, issues related to, as I understand, what we're going to talk about today is performance incentives for our chancellor presidents and vice chancellors. Would you like me to begin with a little background, or do you have questions? How would you like to proceed?
Go ahead with your presentation, please.
Okay. By way of background and information, Mr. Chair, I would just say that I think Mr. Hubinger did a good job in his summary to you indicating sort of the legislative history a little bit, but I would like to expand on that just a little bit regarding the performance incentive payments that we utilize in our system for our chancellor presidents and vice chancellors. As you all are aware, Minnesota Statute 43A20 actually requires that for all non-bargaining unit employees that any pay that's given to those individuals be based on performance evaluations. That means, in effect, that the person performs and then we make a decision about what pay, if any, that individual is going to receive. And so our intent with our incentive program is to match exactly what the legislative requirement is. I think you all are also aware that the personnel plan for our MNSCU administrators does allow for additional compensation up to 30%. That was added with the approval of this committee and the legislature back in 2000 for both the chancellor and the presidents, and then in 2001 for the vice chancellor. So we do have a provision in the personnel plan that's been endorsed by this committee, a longstanding provision that talks about our ability to provide additional compensation over the base salary for up to 30%. We have historically used that for incentive payments, for a travel communication allowance, and for a housing allowance for our chancellor and for our state university presidents in order to keep comparable with what's happening around the United States with respect to other university presidents. We have always, in terms of MNSCU, had the position that with our administrators, we always pay them as kind of a look back. They perform for the year, and they have an evaluation, and then any pay, whether it's a merit-based pay increase or whether it's an incentive-based pay increase, it's always been done as a look back based upon the evaluation that takes place at the end of our fiscal year generally. This is in contrast to what happens for our bargaining unit employees, where if we negotiate an increase for them, they get that increase as the year begins. They would get that, for example, on July 1st. In this case of 09, all of our bargaining unit employees got increases, whereas our administrators did not. There were no base salary increases for those individuals. I just want to point out a couple of things with respect to, in particular, the chancellor's incentive payment. The chancellor in his contract has been eligible for this additional 30% incentive payment since 2001. And so starting in 2002, there was a provision in his contract that said that he would get, and it wasn't a variable rate, but that he would receive an incentive of 30% of his base salary minus the total paid for housing and transportation. This particular provision was utilized with respect to the chancellor from 2002 through 2007. In that time, he received incentives anywhere from a low of $37,800 to a high of $54,588. Starting in the year 2008, the Board of Trustees for MNSCU determined that rather than just making that a payment that he received so long as he was performing satisfactorily, that they wanted to make it more of a true incentive-based payment, and that is that they would say you can get up to this amount depending upon your performance. And so they initiated an elaborate process whereby in the chancellor's performance evaluation cycle, he would agree upon goals that he would achieve throughout that particular year. The board would do an assessment of how he progressed towards those goals, and then they would decide what, if any, incentive he would receive. In 2008, the incentive he was eligible for was up to $25,000, and he received $23,500. And I would just note that's less than half of what he had received under the previous provisions. In 2009, his contract was amended, and that incentive was up to $50,000. And this year, he received an incentive of $32,500. Again, far less than, about $5,000 less than an incentive he received under any of the previous provisions from 2002 and 2007. That's not to say that that makes necessarily the public information surrounding these bonuses any less difficult to try to sell, but it is the history of what's been going on with regard to the chancellor's pay. With regard to the president and vice chancellors, again, starting in 2002 through 2007, there was a provision in each of their employment contracts that each of them would receive, as long as there was, excuse me, please, overall satisfactory performance, an incentive of $2,000 per year. It was just granted. It was given to each president and to each vice chancellor. Again, starting in 2008, the Board of Trustees decided that they wanted to make that more of an actual incentive and an actual pay-per-performance type of provision. So they instituted, again, in the contracts that were negotiated with the presidents, a provision that said that the presidents could receive anywhere from $3,000 to $15,000 based upon their actual performance. Again, an elaborate review process is undertaken whereby there are goals established and data collected and gathered about how they are working towards achieving those goals. And I think Mr. Hubinger provided you a summary of the kinds of goals that are utilized with regard to the presidents and vice chancellors so that you could get a sense of the kinds of things our presidents are being measured on. In any event, I do have, if you're interested in it, a summary of the overall pay for all of the presidents for the FY09 payments that were recently made. They ranged in anywhere from our presidents and vice chancellors from $3,000 to $12,000. Nobody received the total award of $15,000.
Ms. Lamb, do you have a copy of that? Maybe we could send that around to members.
I do have
here.
A copy of it.
And just for clarification for members up here, this is just kind of for our information. It's not an action item, but certainly it's relevant with, and I understand it's been in the news some, and so anyways.
I'm taking that off of another piece of paper here so that it's there. Jim can finish doing that. I'm finished doing that. Those are copies.
Please continue. Sorry.
Nope, that's all right. That's a great question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I would also like the commission to truly understand is that the presidents and the chancellor were not the only employees receiving incentive pays for fiscal year 2009. On the backside of the sheet that's being handed around is the summary of other incentive payments to other groups for 2009. I do this not to begrudge the other groups their incentive payments, but to simply indicate something that I don't think that has been in the media very well, is that the presidents and the chancellor are not the only ones getting this. In fact, the payments made to other bargaining unit groups, it might not be on the back of that large sheet, Mr. Chair, but it's on the back of the other smaller sheet that Mr. Lee can make sure you get a copy of. The other payments to other incentive payments to other groups far exceeds what was paid to our chancellor, presidents, and vice chancellors. We don't hear about that in the media, and we're not begrudging them that. We owed them that. They earned that, and we're happy to pay that. But it's important, I think, for this commission to understand that the incentive payments to the presidents and chancellor and vice chancellors are not the only incentives that are going on. I also would just say in conclusion that when you take a look at the average increase to our presidents, to our vice chancellors, et cetera, for FY09, that these lump sum payments amounted to for our presidents, and I stress lump sum for a reason. Other bargaining units received increases to their base. That means they have tails, and they go on and on and on, and they get paid cumulatively over that over the coming years. These performance incentives we pay to the chancellor and the presidents are lump sum, and they're one-time payments, and they have no tails associated with them. So when you compare the side-by-side, I think it's important to note that distinction. But I would also say that when you look at the amount of the increase for this lump sum payments to our chancellor, to our presidents and vice chancellor, they're small in comparisons to the increases to other bargaining units that occurred in fiscal year 09. For example, the presidents received an average of 5.24% increase through these lump sum, again, with no tails and no cumulative effect, whereas in FY09, our faculty received a percent increase equivalent about to 8.8%. In FY09, the classified units received increases equivalent to about 5.5%. So I think they're, at minimum, smaller than, if not comparable to, the increases received by the other bargaining units in FY09. I'd like to stop now and open it up to any questions that you might have that we can answer so that you can understand exactly what our position has been on these matters.
Thank you, Ms. Lamb. You know, the world's changed a little bit in the last couple of years, mm-hmm. and I quite honestly, I mean, I don't speak as chair in this role, but, I look around, like some of our staff, I don't think they're seeing any of those percentages, and I'm certain that some of the contracts that Mr. Larson's brought forward throughout the state, they're not seeing those percentages. So that's the awkwardness of this is, the world's changed, and, we've got some people that are, quite honestly happy to have a job or staying where they're at, and then we have, I understand it's been negotiated in good faith and all that, but the world has changed, so I think you need to be careful as you move forward. Any questions? Senator Betzel.
Mr. Chair, I noticed, and thank you for the list showing the compensation. I noticed two of the presidents, the president of Anoka Technical College and the president of Lake Superior College, had zero for their incentive performance. Why was that? Did they not accept them, or what happened there?
Ms. Lamb.
Mr. Chair and Senator Betzel, that is because there was an overall determination that performance was not satisfactory.
I see. And Senator Betzel. And Mr. Chair, and I was contacted by constituents before the news media thing, and you know, people who were upset for some of the reasons you suggested. And Ms. Lime, I recognize you're just the messenger here and so forth, but I think it was problematic this, you know, last, not only this last session but previous ones, trying to deal with, you know, higher education budgets and having to, you know, raise tuition, you know, cut programs for a lot of students, and then, you know, having this come about, I think the timing is awkward is the best way I can describe it. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator Betzel. Any other questions?
Amen.
Any other statements?
Amen.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would mimic some of what Senator Betzel said. Ms. Lamb, can you help me understand the communication allowance? What is that? Is that reimbursing for their cell phone, or what do we have there?
Ms. Lamb.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Hilstrom, or Representative Hilstrom. No, it's a payment to each person of $600 a month, a total of $7,200 a year, in recognition for the amount of travel that they undergo and the communication that they do. It's not a direct reimbursement for cell phones, et cetera, but I would say that we don't reimburse on top of that for cell phones and those types of things.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Ms. Lamb, can you, once again, as I understood your presentation, you had said that in the past, they actually did submit, or there was language in the contract to reimburse for what were perceived as actual expenses, and actually those were greater than what you were seeing. Could you go through that again? How and why did we go to the new system?
Ms. Lamb.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative. How and why did we go to the new system on performance incentives?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. I wasn't sure if you were still talking about the communication allowance or not, so thank you for that clarification. The Board of Trustees made a decision that rather than simply getting an incentive payment automatically without regard to what performance was or what might have happened with regard to the achievement of goals during the year, they wanted to add the element of risk, and that is that if you didn't achieve your goals, you weren't going to receive the full amount of an incentive. From the years 2000 through 2007, those incentive payments that were built into the contracts were automatic. There was no risk. There was no up-to amount. It was an automatic amount given to each person. For the presidents and vice chancellors, it was $2,000, and for the chancellor, it was an amount up to 30% of his base, less the transportation and communication allowance and the housing allowance. So there was an absolute automatic guarantee that those incentive payments were going to be made. In 2008, the board moved toward a true pay-for-performance philosophy. They wanted to reward excellence. They wanted to reward good performance, especially in tough economic times. And they wanted to make sure that the amount received was commensurate with the performance that was given. Does that help?
It does. Thank you.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Lamb, the housing allowance, what are the housing? I see there's $168,000 across the system for housing allowances. Can you tell us about that?
Ms. Lamb.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative. There is, when we look at compensation for our university presidents, who are the ones who receive the housing allowance, and the chancellor, it is the norm for universities like ours, and we look at compensation with respect to all of our peer institutions. It is the norm in the higher education world that university presidents either are given a house on a university campus to live in as part of their compensation package, or that they're given some sort of a housing allowance because we expect them, as part of their job, to have events at their home that are official university or chancellor-sponsored events, and the housing allowance is to help compensate them for what happens at their home that we expect them to do as part of their job. Again, to stay competitive and attract and retain presidents at our universities and chancellors, this is what's expected across the United States. Jim, is there anything to add?
Chairman.
No. Senator Metzen.
Yeah, just following up on that a little bit, are only 7 of the 50 people
state universities
that open up their homes? And I mean, how come they're not all getting the housing allowance?
Again, because
Islam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and
maybe I missed it.
State universities.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Metzen, again, that's when we look at compensation, it is the norm for state university presidents, who are our peer group, to receive either to be given a house to live in. I don't know if you heard in the news this weekend about the housing.
I heard that testimony. You know that.
Right.
But why not? I mean, why just 7?
Sure, Mr. Chair and Senator Metzen. It is not the norm in the colleges and technical colleges field to pay compensation for housing. And so we look at our peer groups and make sure we're doing what our peer groups are doing, and it is not the norm for the colleges and technical colleges presidents to receive that kind of compensation.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Lamb, of those 6 or 8 or however many are receiving $24,000 for housing allowance, the state of Minnesota is paying them for the opportunity for people to come and meet with them in their house. Is that what we're paying them for?
Ms. Lamb.
Chair Lilly and Representative, yes, that and other things, that and the entertainment that they do there, the opportunities that people have to go there, the events that they hold at their house that are official university-sponsored events, yes.
Representative Drazkowski.
Ms. Lamb, how is this, where is this authorized, and where does the MNSCU receive the authority to provide this housing allowance?
Ms. Lamb.
Mr. Chair and Representative Drazkowski, it's provided in the personnel plan for MNSCU administrators under the 30% additional remuneration provision of the personnel plan.
Representative Drazkowski.
So MNSCU is basically Ms. Lamb, so you're saying MNSCU is basically providing this as part of their contract with the presidents as a benefit, as they would anything else?
Ms. Lamb.
Mr. Chair and Representative Drazkowski, yes, that's correct. And Mr. Lee is going to hand you up the provision of the personnel plan that prescribes this.
Thank you.
Any further questions at this time, Representative? Or?
I could go on all day, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Okay. Good questions.
I think this issue is going to come
any
up.
Any other questions?
It's going to come up again.
From our senators? Hey.
Oh.
Okay. Just out of curiosity, Ms. Lamb, you seem very competent. Do you get a bonus?
I haven't yet, but I will be eligible. It is in my contract.
Okay. Where is that?
Senator Metzen.
Senator Janicich's numbers on here. Just, are you way off the chart?
You should pay them.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
A lot of senators.
Maybe this committee could fix that up for you. Times are tough. Yeah.
Mr. Chair and Senator Metzen, I'm sure he would welcome that.
A lot of senators in the crowd today.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One last question, Ms. Lamb. Can you review again for us the normal increases to the base that happen for these individuals and how they happen?
For
Ms. Lamb.
Mr. Chair and Senator Representative Drazkowski, for FY09?
For any fiscal year, yeah.
Yes, I'd be happy to.
How do those increases happen? How are they determined? How are they applied?
Mr. Chair and Senator Drazkowski, thank you. Any increase to the base or otherwise, and again, I would emphasize these incentive payments are not to the base, but any increase for any one of our administrators is based upon the prior year's performance. So there has to be a year of performance, a performance evaluation process, and then a determination of what, if any, increase would be granted. For administrators, generally, each year they undergo an evaluation process that's documented in writing, and then their manager, supervisor, their direct person over them would typically, in the case of all the administrators or presidents, would make a decision about what, if any, increase to give for administrators on the campuses. And with regard to the presidents and vice chancellors, the chancellor would make a recommendation to our board.
Representative Drazkowski.
Last question, I promise. Ms. Lamb, so they've kind of got two tracks of performance pay going for them, is what it sounds like to me. I mean, if they perform well, they get an increase to their base commensurate with their performance, and they also get a one-time performance pay increase of these up to $2,000 to $6,000 or whatever it is here. Is that correct?
Ms. Lamb.
Mr. Chair and Representative Drazkowski, no, that's not correct. For this year in the personnel plan for administrators, there were no base increases at all for any administrator. The only increases given were these incentive payments that are given pursuant to a personal evaluation that happens at the end of the year. So for FY09, for example, there were zero base increases for any administrator in our system. The only increases given in FY09 for the chancellor, the presidents, and the vice chancellors were these performance incentive payments that are outlined in that attachment that you receive.
How about past years?
For years in the past, excuse me, Mr. Chair and Representative Drazkowski, for years in the past, there have been, for other administrators, merit-based increases that, again, are done at the same time. And so they're not two tracks, but these would be done at the same time as any incentive payments would be done. For administrators other than the chancellor, other than the presidents and the vice chancellor, they have a merit pool. For the presidents, the vice chancellors, and the chancellor, they have these incentive payments. There have also at times been adjustments to the base for market conditions, looking, for example, at how we're doing comparatively with other of our peer institutions across the states, and those would be merit-based market adjustments. But they happen at the same time, so there's not parallel processes running.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Lamb, for your presentation. Seeing no further questions, good job for your first run. Very impressive. So.
I thought the guy on the left was wonderful.
Pardon me?
He did a good job, too.
He did a great job.
Mr. Lee did.
You were the best
picker
several times.
He kicked me and provided moral support, and that was greatly appreciated. So thank you for the opportunity to address you today.
There's no other items on the agenda, so we're there again. Mr. Larson, thank you very much for your service, and all the best to you. And and thank you to our staff, Sally and Ms. Kidd and Mr. Hubinger. I enjoy your reports, and they are always helpful. And thank you, Mr. Shepard. So with that, we are adjourned.
I've got the body. What are they doing?
The body.
About one of the programs.
I would cross it.